Okay, here we go.
Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, everyone. This is Fran Lewis, and this is Book Discussion. And we have an unbelievable show today. We have two absolutely amazing, fantastic New York Times bestselling authors. But before I start the show, I would like to say that I am dedicating this show to those people in Boston and the Boston Marathon, to the memory of the three people that lost their lives and to their families. Our hearts and prayers go out to you, and we hope that they catch whoever it is that did this, and they will send a message to the rest of the world: don't mess with America. If for those of you that watched the interfaith service today on all of the channels, the mayor and the governor of Boston are to be commended, the EMT, the doctors, the nurses, everyone that helped, even the volunteers on the street. And I have to say, whether you agree with his policies or not, President Obama, your speech was so amazing that if I had to review it today, I would give you 5 golden stars and 5 golden American flags. So to those people in Boston, our hearts are with you today, and we hope that we can bring some sunshine into everyone's life with our show today. And on that note, I would like to introduce my guest, my very favorite author in the whole world, of the Eve Duncan series. And she's going to tell you something about the book, but she's not going to tell you all of it, because you know what? Taking Eve is, did it come out yet? I'm not even, no, it came out, it just came out this week.
And came out on Tuesday.
Came out on Tuesday. Yeah, I have to post my review. I never post a review until the book comes out. It's the Eve Duncan, but I would like to welcome Iris Johansson. Hi, Iris.
Hi, how you doing?
Oh, just peachy. It's beautiful up in upstate New York. The sun is shining, and the greatest thing is I didn't need a jacket today, so that's even better.
So well, I'm down in Atlanta, and we have wonderful weather today.
Oh,
that's
great.
Doesn't happen all the time at this time of year. As you know, we're in the tornado belt.
Yeah, well, it's been kind of horrible, and Marcia Cook, that does a good story, is a good story, called me this morning to say that she's underwater.
Oh, no.
Bethany, I don't know if you know, her office is closed, and everything is flooded in Chicago. And they're threatening us with this lovely storm, which I really hope we don't get, because Fran's nephew's bar mitzvah is this weekend. So happy birthday, Jakey. My nephew turns 13 on Saturday, and I just hope we don't get rained out, because some of it's going to be outside, but that's okay. His aunt is bringing his computer, like I promised, and that should be interesting. So tell everybody a little bit about Taking Eve. This is a trilogy, right?
Yes, it's the second trilogy that I've written about Eve Duncan. As you know, the first trilogy was tremendously successful, not only because it answered a lot of questions, but because I got to develop Eve and several other characters, and it became so interesting to me that I think that it came across in the books. Now, this trilogy, everybody was very much afraid that after I tied up the last trilogy that they were going to have to say goodbye to Eve, because it, you know, it seemed sort of permanent. And, you know, I told everybody then that no, that Eve would just take different paths, and her attitudes would change, and some parts of her character would change. And when I got this idea for the second trilogy, I thought it's got to be completely different, and yet it's got to do the same thing. It's got to develop new aspects of her character that the reader's never seen before.
And it definitely does. It definitely does. We see a different side of Eve. We won't say what. And we see a different side of Jane. And, of course, Joe is probably the most overprotective person I've met. What can I say?
But don't we like that about him?
Because yeah, we do like that about him.
He loves Eve so much.
But he's still not married to her. This is not good.
Fran, forget it.
I know that. I figure that not only are they not going to ever get married, but I figure by the time you get done with all of the books, we're going to throw in a couple of more guys to confuse her.
Well, why not? I mean, that's life, isn't it? But I don't know. Joe is so wonderful.
Yeah, he really is. But I know there are a couple of others that are waiting in the wings in case she changes her mind.
Oh, this is true, too. This is true, too.
I know.
And I can't guarantee what will happen, ever.
Well, you know, we're never going to get rid of Eve or whatever. I don't know if you'd ever kill her off. I doubt it. Let's hope we don't. At one point, I thought in one of your books, in the Bonnie trilogy, in the Quinn trilogy, I thought maybe we were going to kill off Joe. And I said, no, she wouldn't do that to me. She can't do that to me. The guy's too cute. You know, if Eve doesn't want him, we'll get him a blind date or something. Got to do something.
We'll raffle him off on Facebook or something.
Trust me, I can. All I have to do is put it on my reviewing your book site on Facebook, and you've got about 20 women that maybe more. Every book reviewer in the world will take Joe. All we need to have, we need to put him on the front cover of a book, though. We've got to get a picture.
But, you know, every time they do Joe on the cover of a book, it doesn't, they do the best they can. That, you
not
know,
very well.
His face is in my head. And
yeah, I know.
It can't be on the cover of a book, and it's probably in the heads of every reader who's read about Joe.
Mm.
So no one's going to be happy about Eve or Joe because everyone has their own idea of what they look like.
Yeah, well, I'm looking. I'm not going to tell them what I'm looking at. I'm just telling. I'm looking at a picture of possibly Eve, and the description that you give and the picture. Oh well. They need to change it before the third one comes out. That's all I'm going to say. Okay, so she doesn't have the right color hair, and it doesn't look like that. She looks more like a Victoria's Secret model in this picture, which is not a bad thing, but then I don't think he wants to be Victoria's Secret model. I'm not sure. Okay, so Joe is very attached to Eve. So why does he feel that when he goes off to play to be detective, whatever, that she needs to not be by herself?
Well, you know, he's not like that all the time, but he's very protective of Eve, as you say, and in this particular case, his instincts are just screaming, you know, that something's wrong, that something's not right, and because of that, you know, he's got a few paranormal instincts as well, as I've brought out in other books, and I try to leave them on the downside because we can't have Joe dominating a book, and he would if I brought in that aspect of his character. But he's very highly sensitive, and he feels in this case that something could go wrong, and that's why he doesn't want to leave Eve alone.
Mm. Well, I wish I had him around because there are times I don't want to be alone either. You know, I know he's terrific, but Jane is supposed to come, correct, and stay with and visit Eve. How come she doesn't get there? What causes her to be detained?
Well, what causes her to be detained is a part of the main plot of the villain, and he wants Eve to be alone.
Well, the villain wants her to be alone, but we're not going to say why the villain wants her to be alone. Because
really,
then,
because I'm like that, aren't I, Fran?
I know. I know. We're not going to tell anybody because they have to read the book, because that would spoil the fun of finding out all this fun stuff by themselves. I know.
That's right.
I know. Okay, so tell everybody a little bit about Jane, because Jane is a big part of this particular book. And if Jane doesn't, you know, come to see Eve or whatever, or is detained, Eve is not going to be too happy. And Joe's not going to be too happy. So what happens that Jane gets waylaid? What's the problem?
Well, Okay. The problem, of course, is that the villain plots that she will be waylaid. And you said you wanted me to tell you a little bit about Jane.
Yeah, tell everybody about Jane.
Well, many of the readers know Jane very well. I've actually written a few of the E. Duncan books that are where she's actually the star character in them. Jane is Eve's adopted daughter, and she was a street kid, grew up rough in half a dozen homes, and when she was 10 years old, Eve adopted her. They got together and in an adventure in the Killing Game, as a matter of fact, and they became close, and Eve adopted Jane. And since that time, she's been more best friend than daughter to her because of the upbringing she had. She was almost an adult when she was 10 years of age, and she was like Eve in many ways, both physically and mentally, because Eve grew up kind of rough also.
Mm.
And then in later years, Jane went to college, and she became involved with Trevor, a real hunk, as you call him, Fran.
Oh, he's cute, Mark Trevor, yeah.
And then she had a few adventures on her own. She's never totally committed to anyone because of the fact that she can't trust anyone really but Eve because of her background.
Well, who's the other guy that's in the book that's fighting
for? Oh, Seth Caleb.
Oh, my God.
Seth Caleb is quite a man, isn't he?
Yeah. He makes somebody want to cheat on their husband. That's not good. Both of them could. Seriously.
Well, Seth Caleb has appeared in a couple of the books with both Jane and Eve before. So he comes in and out like a sort of very sexy phantom. He's completely different from Trevor, who was her former lover, and yet again, you know, she doesn't feel like she could trust Seth either, because Seth is a very wicked boy. Yeah, actually, that was a very interesting part of. Taking Eve, dealing with the Jane, Seth, and Trevor angles.
And she's not going to choose either one of them yet. Anyway, that would spoil everybody's fun. That would definitely. I know. She's not going to get the right. She's not going to pick the right one. I mean, after all, if she chooses whichever one, that would kill everybody's fun. And besides the fact, there could always be a third one.
You never can tell what's going to happen with Jane, because Jane doesn't really like commitment, and she doesn't know. She doesn't really want anything to tie her down except her relationship with Eve. Eve is everything to her.
Well, Eve is everything to her, but that took her time also. Took her time to be able to trust Eve also. It didn't happen overnight. I remember that. I read every one of your books. You have to remember that. I read them all. So Toby is Jane's dog, right? And Toby is the reason why she's waylaid. And when she realizes that Sarah is not going to be the one to take care of her and this new girl is, how come she's not really sure that's a good thing?
You mean the emergence of Margaret?
Margaret, I love Margaret. I wish I had the power of Margaret. My brother has a Rottweiler, and her name is Bella. I call her Bella. She's so cute. And I wish I had Margaret's talent so that I could know what Bella was thinking, because Bella's just so precious. And she loves me because I scratch her back and nobody else does. So what happens to Toby, and how does Margaret, why is she so special?
Well, Margaret is a, well, she refuses to call herself a dog whisperer because, but she does have an ability to join with animals. And she appears when Toby, the dog, becomes ill.
Mm.
And she's, I loved Margaret.
Me too.
I still do. She's, in many of these books, as you've noticed, there's a lot of darkness. And when I started writing this, I said, no, I've got to have something that's a bright light. And so I made, I created her, but she just sort of came in. She's optimistic, and she's strong, and she's funny, and she is, and yet she has an element of toughness too. That
yes.
That she's, I really like her.
I like her too, and I hope you're going to bring her back in the next two, but I'm sure I'll know that after I read them when they come out or before they come out.
Well, as you know, Fran, I asked them to schedule them very close together, just like the other trilogy, because I get very, very frustrated with trilogies because, you know, they schedule them like a year apart. No way. I'd throw the book across the room.
Well, I have to tell you, the only one that gets them to do that, because I work with Hayward Smith, and she was on my show last week. She's hilarious. Her out of warranty had me on the floor. I was oh my God, it was hysterical. And the Red Hat Club was a riot. But her next book is going to come out in a while. And most of the people that work with St. Martin's or any publishing company, it takes them about a year before the next one comes out. So they know better than to, you know, to tell you what you did. They just do what you say, which is really good.
Oh, come on! They just cooperate, and because they know, as I do, that it can be terribly frustrating. So they're very, very good. Mm-hmm. They schedule me very close together on these trilogies. Three in 1 year with just months between them. That's great. That's very unusual, really.
Well, I'm sure that by the time the show is over and May comes, I imagine the next one will be in my hand, and I hope they send it to me soon because I only have 27 books inside that I'm reading. I had 27 books or 30. That was supposed to have been 30, and I get Taking Eve about a month and a half ago, and I go, okay, that one's first. And I just grabbed it. And then John Lescaut's book came, and I go, oh, good, thank God I have another one that's good. And I literally have, 25 or 26 inside, and thank God John Land sent me his book. I know it's going to be fantastic. And I've got Maya Angelou's new book, and I know that seems to be interesting also. So once in a while I get good stuff, and then there's the rest of the stuff, and I don't pan books ever. So when I get your book, you know it's just going to the top of my list. As somebody's book came yesterday, it's interesting paranormal thing here, and I'm saying like it came yesterday, he should be waiting. No, he's not. I'm going to finish it later. So what really happened? Toby is sick, and Jane starts to form like a bond with Margaret, and she starts to trust her. But what did they say was wrong with this poor dog? What was wrong with him?
We're not going to say.
We're not going to tell anybody. Okay, good. We're not going to tell anybody. He just didn't feel well that day.
Oh, okay. Yeah, you know how.
You know, I know. He just didn't feel well, poor Toby. Poor thing. But, you know, and we're not going to tell you if he gets better either because it's none of your business out there. Okay. Now we have Margaret. Margaret can sense things not just around dogs, right? She can sense things around people too.
Well, she even makes fun of the self. She says, "You think I can read minds? No way." But she says, but at the same time, she does she can sense things about people that a lot of people can't sense. She's very, very highly sensitive about people.
I would imagine she's almost like our own private psychic, sort of, or something like that. Yeah.
Well, she would deny that. She would just say that it's just something that happened, and you know if you think a dog can sometimes sense what you're feeling, why can't you sense what a dog's feeling or thinking?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's why I wish I could tell what Bella Bell is thinking, because you know she's got my three nephews and my brother and my sister-in-law, and that poor dog. She needs me. But you'll have your aunt tomorrow. Don't worry. Yep. I think the first time I saw her, I was like, oh, my God, a Rottweiler. And I looked at my brother, and I go, you actually have a dog. You got to be kidding me. It's his excuse not to have to go anywhere because they have to take care of Bella Bella. And the boys, you know, they help out, but basically they're in school and they have like 97 hours of homework. So what can I say? Eve is part of this, Joe and Jane, and we're not going to talk about what happens to them, but who is Blick? And we'll just touch on him lightly.
Blick is a bad guy. And he's very heavily involved in the plot.
And that's all we're going to say about him, right?
Right.
I know that we're having a technical difficulty here today. I'm just trying to figure out.
Are we?
Who's in the chat room and who's not. I'm going to need someone afterwards just to get the second author on, because I called in as... Okay, we're good. We're okay. Now, last week what happened was Heywood Smith couldn't get on, so I had her phone number. But a lot of publicists like yours, you know, they hesitate to give somebody the author's phone number. And the only reason why I would ask for the phone number is just in case the person has trouble signing on to Blog Talk Radio. And John Land... we had to call him, and we had to call Heywood last week because the system, what can I say? And unfortunately, when I was interviewing Elliot Patterson, I got knocked off myself. And I don't know what happened while I got knocked off, but there was nobody there.
What happened?
It was kind of horrible.
Is it sunspots or something, or what?
I don't know. I think some. I have no. All of a sudden, you just go out. What could I say? You just, like, I got bumped off. So it took me, like, a couple of times, you know, to get back on. And then if that happens, I just call back in and pray that somebody else will speak or say something. It makes it kind of hard, yeah. So let's see. Who is Ben? Can we talk about Ben?
Oh, yes. Ben has a spot in this book also. And many of the readers will remember Ben because he appeared in Bonnie, the last book of the trilogy.
Mm.
And a lot of people fell in love with Ben because, you know, he's a sweet, sweet boy. And he was close to Bonnie. He'd dream of Bonnie a lot.
Well, Bonnie comes into play in this, doesn't she? We hear from Bonnie. She's not completely gone, people. She's there, right?
No, Bonnie is still there. She has a strong role in the books, even though a lot of times she's not evident.
Mm.
You have to read the book to understand. But Bonnie is definitely there, and Eve loves her just as much and wants her with her just as much.
Well, there was one scene, I think you'll talk about this one, that's okay, I'm just adding it in here. There was one scene that was almost hilarious between Caleb and Trevor when they were in the same room together, and when with another character, we won't say why. But when the two of them get in the same room together, Caleb and Trevor, what happens?
Well, Caleb and Trevor are both involved with Jane. Mm. And they strike sparks off each other.
Mm.
And in fact, I had to quiet it down a little bit during the book because that isn't what the book was about. It was just an emotional reaction. But they did definitely interact in a fiery manner.
Yeah, I know they do. There's like sparks and like one person in between. But I'm just hoping that you bring both of them back again because that makes it more fun.
Well, the thing with when you're writing a book with so many characters,
mm-hmm.
and characters that people know and care about, that you can't cheat on any of them. So you can't just leave one character dangling. You have to complete it and make their particular story as interesting as the next one.
Well,
even though
do.
Eve was the paramount focus of this book, there was also the people who cared about her and surrounded her.
Oh, my goodness, the postman's bringing me more books. As we speak, number 30 and 31, I know my husband's going to answer the door. Yeah,
maybe you'll get something really good, Fran.
I don't really want any more, but all I can say is that my next-door neighbor, you know, people in this building are very interesting. They don't say hello or anything, but I give her all of my books, and she shares them with hospitals, or she'll share them with the people in the building. So I gave her, like, 50 books this morning, and she got me these beautiful yellow roses. So I get a lot of flowers when I give people books, so that's cool. So I don't think it's roses. I think it's another book. Or I'm expecting like about 15 more, but that's okay. I'll just add it to the pile. Okay, we're going to talk in generalizations because this should be okay. What are Eve's major qualities that you might consider her to be a survivor? And is Jane the same way?
Well, number one, Eve is a survivor because of her inner strength and her endurance. And let's face it, she's been through hell.
Yeah.
And she's suffered and fought and come out on top. And Jane is the same. That's why they are so close. As I said, they both had a rough childhood. And they weren't able to trust people during that early period. But Eve was resurrected when she had Bonnie. And Jane was resurrected when she found Eve. So in many ways, they are the same in emotion as well as looks, because if you read Killing Game, you'll realize that when she was a child, she looked a lot like Bonnie, and like Eve. Jane did, and she still has some of the physical characteristics.
But Jane at first also resented Bonnie, didn't she? And her memory, correct? She wasn't too fond. It's just recently that she sort of came to understand Eve's feelings for Bonnie, and that, you know, one was different than the other, and that she was just as special, right?
Jane never really resented Bonnie. She felt not as special.
Yeah.
She's never felt as special to Eve as Bonnie, because she realized how important Bonnie was to Eve. But she never resented her. It was a painful. Whenever she thought about Bonnie, there was an element of pain. But she never blamed Eve. Never.
No. So how come Eve is so special to everybody? Why would so many people, you know, go out of their way or risk just about anything for her? And if Joe could give you a definition of justice, what would he call it? See, I'm not talking about the book. I'm doing good. I have
why,
my yes
why,
questions
why,
and my
why
no.
Why are so many people being searching desperately for Eve?
Why would they search desperately? Why would they do anything for her, go out of their way for her? I mean, Joe and Jane would literally stop their lives just for her. So would a whole lot of other people. How come?
Well, you know, there are some very special people in this world.
Mm-hmm.
When you think about Eve and the way she gives all of her life to try to bring resolution to the parents of all those children that, you know, are just virtually thrown away. And also the mm-hmm. fact that, you know, just being around her she's strong and you want to protect her, and yet you realize that in many ways she could protect you. She's a very, very special person, and people sense that.
She's also very headstrong, and when she makes up her mind about something, you can't stop her.
No, you can't, but that's part of the strength.
I know, she reminds me of my late sister. She does. She used to do the same thing. Once my sister decided to do something, forget it. She just kept on going. Okay, so which character in this story controls most of the action?
Oh, heavens. That's hard to say. I mean, this is a multi-character book, as you know. Who controls the action? Eve actually controls the action in this one.
Mm.
Because it's Eve who has to confront a terrible problem and try to overcome it. But at the same time, there are all of the people who are around her and love her that are in motion and having their own lives and moving forward also. So Eve probably controls it, but I think that you'll enjoy bouncing back and forth.
So which locations does this book take place in? That's safe to ask.
What?
Where are the different places that this book takes place, the different locations?
It takes place on an island in the Caribbean. It takes place at the Lake Cottage outside of Atlanta. It takes place in Colorado. It takes place in Vancouver. As I said, it bounces around a bit, but you don't lose control of any of these people.
Well, she's tough, Eve, and I remember when she met Kendra in the other book. And I remember when they first met with the musical therapist, and I remember that the two of them together in the same room was kind of hard. Neither one of them wanted to give in to the other one. I remember that. So I hope you're going to bring Kendra back sometime, because I like Kendra.
Oh, and yes, Kendra. Everybody loved Kendra. And Kendra will definitely appear.
Okay, now I have my other questions here. Okay, here we go. This is page 4. Because I crossed out a whole bunch of questions on this one. Okay, but before we go to the generic questions, the next book is coming out, everybody, Hunting Eve. And I don't have the book. I just have the back cover. And it's coming out in July. So there. And the one after that is coming out in October. That's Silencing Eve, and that's all I'll say about that. And let's hope they don't permanently silence Eve at all. And we're not going to say why. They have, you know, whatever. Eve job is to bring closure to people and to create the skull and the faces. The training that she had to do it is amazing. But there are times that she sort of didn't really want to do it in some cases, right, where she sort of was forced to do it. And yet she becomes emotionally attached to these faces, doesn't she, and these people that she's trying to bring to life?
Yes, that's correct. Most of the reconstructions she does are on children, and they can be it can be a very painful process because it reminds her of her daughter Bonnie. But at the same time, as she actually creates the faces, she becomes closer and closer to them, and actually towards the end, she feels as if she makes almost a psychic connection with them. She gives each of the reconstructions a name, even though they have no name, as far as she knows. And they become part of her life for the brief period when she's creating their faces.
And each time that she creates one of these faces, it's actually amazing that they actually look like the person that it really is. So who are the types that, well, this is a safe question, people. You're not going to get any information about taking it, but you're going to figure out from the title what it means. That's all I'm going to say. Who are the type of people that would hire her? I know that she does mostly children, but how do they come in contact with her? How do they know about her?
Well, a good many of the skulls come from different police departments around the country. They've discovered bones and the skulls in unmarked graves, and they cannot, since there's no way of identifying, there's no DNA. So in order to make the identification, they send the skull to her so that she can reconstruct the features of the child or adult. In most cases, it's a child. And then put it in the newspapers and circulars and hope that somebody identifies the child, and therefore the case is opened to find the murderer.
Now, there are people today that really do this, right?
Yes, there are.
There are people that actually do this. I mean, I don't watch too much of this on television, but I do watch, you know, forensics. I love it. My nephew's taking forensics in high school, and he loves it also. And as a matter of fact, I should say next Thursday, Dr. Mark Rubenstein is a forensic psychiatrist, and he wrote an article on the Huffington Post based on the Boston Marathon that he sent me yesterday to read. He does me research before I interview him. I'm constantly doing... He sends me his research so that I can ask him a whole bunch of questions. It was a phenomenal article.
But that's very interesting, and it's good. Helpful,
it is interesting. I get to learn more, and he sent me a whole bunch of articles for the last one. I'm going, okay, I got it. You want me to read this before I do it? Oh my goodness! Now, one of the questions that I think other people would like to know is, when you have a character in a series like Eve or any other specific character, how do you keep reader interest? How do you make it so that each time we read about Eve, I mean, we're never bored about Eve. It's always, you know, a five-star Eve book, just in case anybody didn't know what I was giving the book. That's what I'm giving it after I'm done here. How do you develop and differentiate Eve each time? How do you keep reader interest?
Well, I try to keep Eve's motivations and Eve's character virtually the same, but I also try to open up new growth patterns within her. And I don't want you to be too sure of her, because how can you be you know, really, really sure about anyone. People change and they grow. And an experience can completely turn you around. And so I try to keep her fresh by making her grow for you.
I don't know why I'm like getting like a foggy sound on my end. I hope that doesn't mean anything. I truly hope it doesn't mean it's going to rain out there. Okay, so when you create a specific plot, do you have a specific technique that you use to keep the plot and have it stay on track so that the characters and the plot go in the direction that you want it to go to?
Oh, I wish I did. That would make it so much easier. Actually, my books are almost entirely character-driven. I come up with the kernel of an idea, and then I think about the characters for a while, and then I start to write, and virtually the book writes itself through the characters.
I wish mine did. I wish most people wish their books would write themselves or the characters.
It can be miserable because, you know, when you get halfway through the book and you say, well, what happens next? What if they don't tell me?
I need to go to sleep and have a dream and hope that they speak to me in the middle of the night.
No, I've tried to write by outline and I can't do it. I start off, you know, being, you know, very, very controlled and very scientific and all of that jazz. And then pretty soon the characters do what they want to do anyway, so I throw it in the wastebasket.
Okay, so I take it that when the book is ended, that the character decides when it's ending, or do you decide that it's ending?
No.
Who's in charge of the ending of the book?
The characters are in charge of the ending of the book. However, I'm in charge of making sure that everything is told before that ending, because that's absolutely essential. As you've seen, my books can be very complicated, and there's many strings to tie up, and you can't end a book, even if a character wants to just go off into the sunset, until everybody knows what's happened, and even me, I have to know what's happening.
Well, the ending of this book I'm not going to tell, but I'll tell you I'm ready for the next one. This was like a really blockbuster ending, and that's all I'm going to say, because it's going to leave you wanting, like, where's the next page and where's the next chapter of the book? And what's going to happen next? Well, that sets the mark of a good trilogy when you end it, and everybody wants to know what happens next. I mean, I've read—I won't even tell you how many trilogies I've read. Too many. And sometimes I do read one, and then the author will say to me, "Would you like the next one?" And go, "No, it's okay." You know, I'm really very busy. I can't deal the next one. You don't want to tell them that the first one wasn't great, but. With Eve, whatever, would you ever write a trilogy with another character?
I'm not saying I wouldn't. I'm saying that trilogies are extremely, extremely difficult.
Yeah.
And I would have to have a very good reason to do it.
Well, I'm just curious to see if you would make Joe the major character or Jane the major character of the next one, or maybe even Kendra. She's good. Her career is really interesting as a music therapist, so it might be interesting to cultivate her. Or maybe she'll give Eve competition with Joe. You just never know.
Kendra was tremendously popular in the Sleep No More and then her own book Close Your Eyes. People love
Kendra. Close Your Eyes was good. Oh yeah, I loved Kendra also. So I can't wait to see what's going to happen if she gets involved in anything else. But we won't say if she is or she isn't, because we're not going to tell anybody. I'm getting really good at this.
You're getting very good at this, Fran.
I know. I'm getting good at not saying anything. This is really good. Okay, so Alan should be here any day now. We don't know soon. What challenges did you face what other challenges do you face when you write the trilogy? Do you have all three figured out at once? Because I know all three are written, right? They're all done. All three of them are finished?
I'm working on the last one now.
You're working on the last one now. We're not going to say. I can't wait to read the second one. Because as soon as I'm done with the show later, I'm going to email Katie because I want my copy of the next one, which is called Hunting Eve, and that's all we're going to say about that. And you can figure out what that means, and if you can't, well, that's too bad. You know, you'll figure it out. Okay. There are days I begin to say to myself, okay, I can do this. You know, it comes to the point that sometimes somebody will ask me a question, and I'll give them a vague answer. I'm going to go, you didn't really answer the question. I said, well, I didn't like what I have no answer because I didn't want to answer your question because I don't have to tell you what you want to know. I'm getting good at that, too. Now, would you ever create an incident, a case where there's a murder in the book and it has nothing to do with Eve? In other words, it's just a plain old murder and there's no skull or whatever, and that any one of the main characters would be a suspect? It's just a thought.
It's a possibility. I'm not saying I might not, because that's always an interesting plot situation. But I doubt if I would involve Eve in it. I might involve Catherine Ling.
I was just going to bring her up. Yes, I didn't forget her.
That would be more her kind of story.
I'm still waiting for Catherine and Eve and Kendra to be in the same novel, trying to solve something.
Well, you know, Catherine Ling, the next book after the trilogy will be a Catherine Ling book, I think.
I love Catherine Ling books. Are you going to bring back the other guy, too, the Chinese guy?
Oh, yes, I love him.
And you have to bring back the son also, right?
Yeah, well, it's part of her life.
Yeah, well, you ended it where you have to bring them all back. Because the ending to the book that she was in was really amazing. Now the other question is, are you going to bring John Gallo back? He's so cute.
Yeah, John Gallo will be back. I don't know exactly in what form. She's really hot for him.
I know. It's about time. Yeah.
But we will see. But, you know, I've always been one of those people who think the very best form of sex is sexual tension in a book.
Well, sometimes it's better because, you know, you don't really know what's going to happen, and it's better. And sometimes sometimes the explicit scenes, they work, and sometimes they sort of ruin it, and they ruin your imagination. Except where Joe and Eve are concerned, what can I say? tell everybody a little bit. Hunting Eve is coming out in July, right?
Uh huh.
And that's all we're going to say about that book. Are there any new characters that are coming in there? Anybody that we're allowed to know about that are coming in there before we find out more information
on Hunting Eve?
Hunting Eve. Are we bringing anybody else?
Okay, I bring a lot of the characters from the first book into the second book, naturally.
Mm.
And there is an interesting character that is one of your favorites that will appear in it. We will not go any further than that.
Oh, cool. Oh, yay.
And
yay.
And the whole taking Eve was great fun. It opened up new aspects of Eve.
Mm.
As you saw in taking Eve, you think of her as the scientist and the artist, but you found out some new things about Eve in that, didn't you?
Yes, I did, and I'm not going to say what they are. But I know she's more of a risk taker in this book. That's all I'll tell you. Say.
And then Honey and Eve, you find more. You find more about Eve. You find out more about other characters. And Honey and Eve moves very, very fast. And I think you'll be very excited about it.
Well, I am going to call to email Katie and John to make sure that I get it really fast, because I know the book is coming out in July, but I am going to try my very best. I promise that I was going to, after I've got one more show next week, I have to tell everybody, Donna Fletcher Crow on Holy Communion, interesting book, and I've got Dr. Mark Rubenstein, forensic psychologist, and his book is Inside Mad Dog House, and he just sent me his new one that's coming out in September that I'm not supposed to ask questions about either, Love Gone Mad, and that's all I'm allowed to say about that. May 9th, I've got my favorite author from England, Bethany. We've got Roger Ellery for 2 hours. And we're going to talk about Candle Moth and who knows whatever else he brings up, whatever he says. He could talk about his music, his life, whatever. We don't know, if you know. On May 16th, we've got John Lesquois, The Ophelia Cut. And right after him, we've got Daniel Palmer, Stolen. Just how far will somebody go to get medical insurance for his wife, and what happens when things get out of hand. And on May 30th, it's like amazing, Steve Berry, The King's Deception. And if you haven't read it, oh, my God, well, you can't until it comes out. It's not coming out yet. I just read it. And we have a few more surprises in June. Sometimes I do something called, I get a little wild, Mystery Tuesday. Well, Mystery Thursday. So on June 6th, we have a New York Times bestselling author, but we can't say who it is. We're not allowed to say who it is. That's going to work with several regular authors that are either traditional or just mystery writers. And this person's going to answer their questions about, you know, characters in the series and mysteries and creating suspense. So that's June 6th. And there's a New York Times bestselling author whose book is inside, the second book, he just sent it to me to read. And we're going to talk to him, Mark Rubenstein, Karen Vaughn, Mark Rem, and a few other people. And who knows what, and I've got one show on June 20th with Ray and Thane, and we have the author after is going to be our own Bethany. We're going to talk to her. Yeah, she's going to be on my show. And we're going to also do a show on June 13th with a man that actually hears ghosts and sees them. Seriously. I think Alan Topol has arrived, but I
Alan
was before
here.
You.
Yes.
Hi, Alan.
Hi, Fran. Listen, I'm going to switch phones. Can you give me 30 seconds, please?
Not a problem.
Okay,
Iris, could you tell everybody where we can get your book?
You can get it anywhere.
You're allowed to say.
You can get it anywhere. In your local bookstore, your local supermarket, your local anywhere.
Okay,
yes, including
there.
Amazon and all over there. So your book is coming out in July, and I'm going to email Katie so we could do an interview in August, right? Does that sound good?
Yeah, or July.
Or July, okay.
Too.
Well, if I do July, it'll be like the end of July, maybe. Okay. I'm going to email her, and maybe we'll do the end of July, like the 29th, because then my husband won't say to me, oh, you're doing something. Again, you're doing what you said you wouldn't do.
Well, that kind of stuff, huh?
Yeah, no, actually, July 25th sounds good. Something like that at the end of the month, we'll do that. I'll figure it out.
That sounds fine.
Okay. Thank you. Oh, my God. And I'm going to make sure that I get your book. And Iris,
I'm here for you.
As usual, Iris Johansson, this was fun. Thank you.
It was great fun, Fran.
Thank you. And I promise I'll come up with some. Thank you. I'll come up with some vague questions for the next one. Don't worry.
Okay, dear.
Bye.
Take care.
Hi.
Bye-bye.
Hi, Alan. How are you?
I'm terrific, and I'm thrilled to be talking to you, as a matter of fact.
I am so glad I finally got to speak to you. Also, Bethany Cross is here. Marcia Cook is here. A lot of people are here.
Oh,
and I am so glad that we were finally able to connect. I know I had an emergency last time.
Right.
Also, I'm hoping you're feeling better.
Oh, I'm feeling terrific. My voice is back. It's fully recovered. as you can tell, all my problems have been solved. So it.
I am so
the
glad.
The thing I had a problem on my larynx vocal cord, it's completely solved. It's modern medicine is sometimes wonderful.
Well, modern doctors, that you can actually find somebody that actually knows what they're doing, that does help too.
That's another matter.
Trust me, I know. Okay,
yes.
I have your book in front of me. I'm very, very, very careful with certain books. My next-door neighbor loves to get all of my books. And I get flowers every time I give her a pile of 50. So I got yellow roses today, but she's not getting this one. I have The Spanish Revenge in my hand, and what happened was Tracy sent it to me. She just sent it, which is really cool. It's, you know, I get stuff from a lot of authors and a lot of publishers, and then they just send me stuff. So they just sent me this, and I go like, okay, this is really good. And any time that I could read over 400 pages in less than 2 hours, we know it's good. So could you give everybody like a summary of the book and give them an idea?
Sure, absolutely. What the book is, it's the second in a trilogy of Craig Page thrillers. I wrote six earlier books, and they had separate characters and never continued the same character. And then I write a book called The China Gambit that came out about a year and a half ago, and I really liked those characters, Craig and Elizabeth and a Chinese General Xu. And so I decided to carry them over to a sequel, which I'd never done before, and this is the book called The Spanish Revenge, and then the third book called The Russian Endgame is scheduled to come out in September. But at any rate, in this book, I deal with an issue. My novels are intended to be fast-paced, very fast thrillers, but strong female and male characters, action, but not a lot of killing people on pages, but ideas. And so woven into the story, I want to work into all my novels an idea. And the idea I want to work in here is in The Spanish Revenge, is the conflict between Muslims and Christians in Western Europe. Because it goes back to the time of the Crusades, it goes back to the battle for Spain between the Muslims and the Spanish. And it also reoccurs throughout history. And the conflict is real and reoccurring now in Western Europe. Because of the demographics, with increasing Muslim populations in many of the cities, larger cities throughout Western Europe, this conflict is surfacing again. And so that's the background issue for what's otherwise a fast-moving story. It's a story of revenge because Craig Page, who's my hero and protagonist in these novels, is trying to gain revenge for the killing of his daughter Francesca, which happened in the first novel, and he's confronting a Chinese General Xu who was responsible for that murder. But on the other hand, this is a standalone novel. You won't have had to read the first book in order to read this book. So it's an idea woven into a fast-moving, very much character-driven novel, and it takes place in Western Europe.
Well, don't think I didn't look it up before to make sure that I had it right.
No, you've got it completely right.
Yeah, I know I did. I try my best. As a matter of fact, I just got an email from Tracy saying that you were writing another book, and don't forget to schedule another interview.
I'd love that.
Oh, not a problem. We'll figure that
right.
one out.
You know, what else I do is I try to do, Fran, and I do that in this book too. I like to work in, besides current events, I like to work in history. Now, even though this book takes place in the present, I go back to the time of Queen Isabella and King Ferdinand, and work in some of that history of the conflict for southern Spain and try to give my readers a sense of the place, because it's a very, very fascinating place. I don't know if you've ever traveled there, but it's an extremely interesting place, and that history is fascinating. I mean, history can't dominate the novel. The novel has to be a story, and it has to have real people. But I like to weave in the history, and I've gotten a lot of favorable comments for that in connection with this book.
Well, it does. Since I don't get to go anywhere, not too far, maybe to to another state, that you could drive to. With my husband's job, he works like 100 hours a day, and he's always on call. Really, it gets to you. In order to visit Spain or Italy or any of these countries, it's great just reading about them in the books that I read. So I, pretend that I went there. What can I tell you?
No, but that's a great point, Fran, because...
Yeah.
When I'm writing about international locales, there are two groups of people. There are those, as you just said, who haven't been to the specific place. And for them, it almost becomes a vicarious journey, the book. But on the other hand, for the people who have been there, you gain something because for them it becomes a kind of remembrance of their trip. And so international locales, I think for novels, are just... become wonderful, but the part and parcel of that is I spend a lot of time trying to get the facts right because it has to be accurate. I don't know how you feel, but if I ever read a book that gets some factual thing basically wrong, like I live in Washington, and if somebody says he went to the State Department and got out of the cab on 16th Street, I'm thinking, oh, the State Department's nowhere near 16th Street. And for me, the whole novel becomes suspect. So, it's tricky with international locales. You got to get them right.
I have to tell you that what I do, if a novel is a historical fiction or has a lot of research, and I've read quite a few of them, as everybody knows, I will look it up. And I'll do the research
good
to make sure that it, yeah, it, and I found mistakes. One or two cases where the author, and I won't say who it was, said that the research for the book came from a specific place, and I found it on Wikipedia. And a lot of the information in the novel was from Wikipedia. The person had quoted it exactly. And I'm saying Wikipedia is okay, but there are other places that have better information. So I'll delve into it a little bit more because I read a really good book on John's Gospel, and I don't know a lot about it, and the author was right on target. Lee Harmon's book was phenomenal, but I looked it up because I said, this is not my area, and he asked me to review it, and oh, my God. And I read it. I got it right. I was very impressed. But I did do a lot of research so that I would understand it, understand the time period and what he was trying to say. So for those of you that send me historical fiction, don't be surprised if Fran looks up the stuff.
Right. So I don't, but as I say, with me, it's the same thing with current events. I'm putting in a little history, but of course I'm writing in the current time. But those background facts, for example, the demographics as between Christians and Muslims in different cities in Western Europe and Paris, for example, of what I put into Paris, the background of the riots, 3 or 4 years ago in Muslim areas north of Paris. I mean, that's the sort of stuff that you as a reader could easily look up. Is that how that started? Did it go right? And at the same time, you could look up the historical stuff that's woven in about Queen Isabel and King Ferdinand. Did he get it right? So I don't know if you've done much looking, but I tried hard to get it right, Fran.
I did because in order to write the review, I have to make sure that I'm right. And for some reason, Alan, everybody reads my reviews. And I have to tell you, if I make a mistake, which I try not to, they tell me. I mean, I think the worst I ever do is maybe, here and there a typo, because if I look at my computer too long, my eyes get buggy. That's why I don't read PDF or E's, because my I get eye strain. I only read print copies. So who is Jack Ramos, and what's his part in this particular book, and who is Elizabeth?
Okay, Elizabeth is the heroine, and what happened is in the first book, Elizabeth was a newspaper editor at a New York newspaper, and she was the editor and boss of Craig Page's daughter, Francesca. And Francesca was on a very big story in Canada, in Calgary. And after Francesca died, and her father and Elizabeth suspected that it wasn't merely an accident. She was in an auto crash where a truck ran into her car in the snow in Calgary. And Craig believed that it was something else and that she had been murdered. And Elizabeth, who had been her boss, teamed up with Craig through the Spanish through the China Gambit, and their relationship blossomed gradually into a romantic relationship, but gradually, but still, they're two strong people, and both of whom were keeping their independence and their separate careers, but still, they teamed up. Elizabeth is a very gutsy woman. I mean, one story about her, a couple of things about her background fact. She's one of five children, grew up in New York City, in Queens, and her father was a New York City cop, as were four of her brothers. In the high school baseball team, she was the only girl. She fought to get a place as a pitcher on the boys' baseball team. And that sort of says a lot about Elizabeth. When the boys went hunting and fishing with the father, she insisted on going too. So she can shoot. She's an independent character, sort of a strong female character, a newspaper editor, and she's about to use her own smarts and her physical ability in this plot, aiding Craig Page. Now, you know, when we meet them in the second novel, they're already in the Spanish Revenge, they're already together, and they're romantically involved, but they're dealing with a common problem that arises, and part of Craig's trying to gain revenge over Chinese General Chu. Craig, as the novel opens, is the head of counterterrorism for the EU, and he's based in Paris. He had formerly been with the CIA, but ended up having a falling out with the CIA leadership because he simply could not tolerate the bureaucracy, and so he fled to Europe. He restarted himself in Italy. He has Italian roots, and he then, as this novel begins, is the head of counterterrorism in the EU. Think of him as the agency, as the kind of the Jack Bauer 24 kind of agency, and that's what he's heading up for the EU. The EU doesn't have that. The EU is sort of disparate and not together, but that's what he's doing. And so Elizabeth is a newspaper reporter working in Paris for an international paper like the International Herald Tribune, and they then become involved in the facts that unfold first a Spanish train bombing, which Craig then gets drawn up into because of his job with the EU, and later it involves the Chinese General Chu.
I have one more question. Well, let's see. What is Musa? Can we say what is Musa?
Yeah, Musa,
and
right, exactly.
I don't want to give away too much. So if I ask a question,
I'm being careful. You know, when you talk about novels, you sort of have to,
as you're doing,
have to whet the listener's appetite, but you can't give away too much. But let's talk about Musa, because he's one of my two villains in the book, so to speak. He and the Chinese General Chu. Musa is an interesting character who I had enjoyed creating. Musa grew up in the slums of Paris, and his parents were both immigrants to France from North Africa, one from, I think, from Algeria, or one from Morocco. But they were Arabs, they're Muslims, they grew up in one of the poor slums. Musa was very, very smart in school, and he found a teacher who took her under her wing, and she sent him to a special school in Paris, got him out of the neighborhood, and after that he got a college degree at an elite French school, a graduate degree another degree at Columbia University, and then he went back to France. And he wanted to do something for the people in the community. I mean, he wanted to try to raise the standard of living and in the community. He had a girlfriend who was a white Christian woman from Paris. And along came the riots, and I don't want to give away too much. Let me just say that the riots changed his view. And suddenly, after the riots, he realized that working within the system wasn't possible in his view. And so he then became a sort of an outlaw, and he was determined to get back at the French establishment, really, and that launched him on his career, really basically is building a terrorist base, and it's from that point that he hitches up with the Chinese general. But so, you know, he's a character who started as sort of an idealist and ended up in kind of a terrorist situation. I mean, I find, and I don't know what your view is, Fran, but I don't want to paint my heroes all white, and I don't want to paint my the villains as all black. I mean, I think that the characters should have some qualities on each side, both ways. And so I'm sort of striving for that, because I don't like the books where, you know, they're just all white and all black. That doesn't work for me.
Well, you don't want to really love the main character too much, but you don't want to hate the villain too much either.
Exactly. I mean, you want the villain to have some redeeming qualities. I mean, it's not, obviously you don't want to be in love with the villain or I haven't done my job, but on the other hand, he should have some, you know, some redeeming qualities, and that's what I was striving for in the Spanish Revenge. And then the beauty of it is you know, without, again, I don't want to give anything away, but the advantage of keeping the characters of Craig and Elizabeth and the Chinese general, I kept them through two books, and then I'm going to have them through the Russian Endgame, which then comes out in September. And I love the idea of getting attached to characters for more than one book. But yet, as I worked on this book, my agent said to me, it's fine to do a trilogy, she kept emphasizing, but this book, each book has to be standalone. And you have to give the reader enough background so that he's not lost, but he shouldn't have to feel he has to go back and read the earlier one. The one that did a good job of that, by the way, was Larson from The Girl with the Tattoo. I don't know if you read that series.
No, I didn't read those. You know what the sad part is that, well, it's the sad part, is that if somebody doesn't send me a book, I don't read it.
Okay. But he, you know, he had those three books, but he spent the whole first 100 pages of book two or book three sort of bringing the reader up to date. I didn't want to do that. I mean, I just...
No, you know, too much. That was the next question besides all the other 37 questions I have here. Backstory can be kind of rough.
Right.
I mean, too much backstory can be much. I mean, in order, I understood where the who the characters were because she gave me enough information in the Spanish Revenge that it didn't matter that I didn't read the first one. It didn't matter at all.
That's the goal, right?
You it was good because if you get too much backstory, then I'm saying to myself, okay, he's writing the next one. Is he going to tell me the same thing that I know in that one and the next one? And by that time, when you have a recurring character, because that's one of the things that we talk about on my Mystery Thursdays or whatever, that if you have a recurring character like Craig or any other character, you don't want to repeat yourself too often.
Exactly.
You want to keep reader interest. So when Craig Page asks for an interview on CNN, what happens? Because he wants an interview on CNN to talk about something. So what happens about the train bombing? So what happens?
Right. Well, he's basically sandbagged by the reporter because again, dancing around it so we don't give anything away to potential readers is the media people knew things and had information that he didn't yet have. And so they spring it on him in the interview, and he gets very upset. But, you know, I like to do these kind of details because this is something that occurs, and you can see that in a media person. I mean, for example, I mean, it's a terrible thing to talk about, but let's talk about the Boston Marathon bombing.
Yeah, we were talking about that at the beginning. We dedicated the show to the memory of all those people at the beginning of the show.
Right. Let's think about the police chief or the of Boston is up giving an interview because I heard his interview afterwards. And suppose one of the media people, you know, raises his hand and says, Well, you know, what do you think about those surveillance photos that were found? Mm. And let's assume that the police chief hasn't yet heard about those.
Whoa.
Heard about those surveillance photos. Wow, he's going to be... Okay, that could come from a reporter from the crowd, but if it comes from a host on a CNN show, he's going to be pretty upset. So that's what happens with, you know, with Greg Page. And so it's, you know, that whole business of newspaper and media interviews is a very, very tricky business, and that's what Greg deals with.
They don't give you. Well, I've done these interviews, and I'm getting good at this. I think we're learning.
But, oh, you're terrific! This is great.
You know what? I don't believe in blindsiding anyone, but I've been interviewed
right.
on a few shows, and I've been blindsided, but I'm quick. But I keep my wits about me and go, like, okay, that's not a problem. I can answer that. But I don't like to do that to authors because that isn't right. We're trying to spotlight your work. But when you do a newspaper article or a CNN report, they don't give you the questions before. It's just a matter of what they want to ask you. You don't know.
Oh, you generally don't. You generally don't know. You sort of. Come in cold, like I did. I did in connection with my earlier books. I did a couple Larry King interviews when he was still doing. Yeah, when he was still doing interviews with authors. I did a couple Larry King, and I've done a couple Jim Bohannon, and they've never. They don't, give me the questions at all. In fact, Larry King, he had a funny way of operating. He said, I show up at the studio, and he says, I want you to know I haven't read your book. And I said,
oh.
And I'm thinking, what kind of interviews is this? He says, well, yeah. He says, I think I liked, I think it we have more spontaneity. I just think he didn't want to spend the time and read the book. But anyhow, everybody has their own way of proceeding. Personally, I can't conceive of doing an interview and not having read and thought about the book. I just can't conceive of
it. No, I read the book, and then, as you know, and then I do the review, but then I have a pencil and paper. And the minute I finish reading the book, if I know that I'm going to interview the author, I write the questions right away, because sometimes I get the book like 3 months or 2 months before, and, you know, you forget. And in between there, I will have read like 25 or 26 more. And I said, well, gee, I better put these questions together so that they are coherent. And I also tell everybody that if there are questions that, you know, sometimes you don't know if the publicist gives the author the questions, so you don't want to blindside anybody. And My last guest is phenomenal. Iris is great, but she didn't get the questions before, so we went through them before the show real fast, because certain questions, you know, certain people will answer certain questions, they won't. And I have my just-in-case-the-author-won't-answer question page. Seriously. And I had to use that because what can I say? So let's talk about what exactly is the Spanish Revenge. How would you define it?
Okay, I would define.
Put that in my review, by the way, sort of.
Okay, I would define the Spanish Revenge this way, and why did I pick the title? Because from the 9th through the 15th century, Spain, particularly southern Spain, was a glorious period for Islam. Islam ruled in southern Spain for those 5 centuries, and there was a relatively peaceful period, freedom of religion. Jews prospered, Christians, a minority, prospered, both minorities prospered. The economy did well. It was a time of great culture as well. Greek classics from Greek and Romans were translated into Arabic, and it was architecture, the Alhambra, other gorgeous buildings that still exist, were constructed. And then that world fell apart because of 2 reasons. It fell apart to some extent because of internal bickering and dissent, but it mostly fell apart because the Christian, uneducated Christian armies from the north came sweeping down through Spain and into southern Spain, and at the end, led by Queen Isabella and King Ferdinand, ultimately destroyed the Islamic world and expelled the anybody who didn't convert to Christianity was expelled, and same for the Jews and the Muslims, and then Christian rule was then established over all of Spain. And so my Spanish revenge is that my character Musa is now paying the rulers of Spain back for what they did to the Muslim people in the 15th century, and he is in the novel trying to retake a portion of southern Spain for the Muslims and thereby gain revenge for what happened in the 15th century. So that's where the you know, that's where the term comes from in my you know, in my thinking.
I have a few more questions.
Sure, okay, as many as you want. Fire them at me. I'm happy to.
How does the reporter implicate the Chinese during the interview when we know who the general is? And why does he think aligning himself with Musa would benefit him? And who's funding this whole bunch of stuff?
Okay. The Chinese, again, I'm sort of, you know, with your questions, I'm dancing a little bit. I'm not, I'm concealing.
That's okay.
You know,
we don't
want to
dance too hard on this.
Yeah, no. But it's okay. Because the Chinese general, when he recognizes that Craig Page is the one, because of his job as head of counterterrorism in the EU, that Craig Page is the one who is investigating the bombing and is the one who is chasing Musa, then General Zhao is determined to gain his own revenge over Craig Page. General Chu has been exiled from China and exiled from the leadership in the Chinese government because of what happened in the China Gambit. And he is now, much as Craig wants revenge against General Chu wants to get revenge against Craig. And the Arabs have a wonderful expression, the enemy of my enemy is my friend, which I used as the title for one of my earlier novels. And so Chinese General Chu will hitch up with Musa because it's a way of getting back at Craig. And as far as funding and finance, General Chu's brother is one of the wealthiest industrialists in China. And the Chinese money then is flowing to help Musa because in the way Chinese General Chu looks at the world, as the 21st century is evolving, there are three great power blocks. There's the West, the Christian West, of course, dominated, led by the United States. There's the Islamic world, which is very much confused and uncertain, except quite large in numbers. And third of all is China and Asian society, which the Chinese are trying to dominate. And General Chu says, well, wait a minute. If I can link up, he wants Chinese dominance, if I can link the Chinese with the Islamic world, then for sure we will be able to dominate the United States and the West. So that becomes a big motivating factor for him as well.
Okay, now there are two characters that I have on my list here, but that's up to you whether we talk about them or not.
Sure.
I'm really good at this, so I'm getting better.
Go ahead. No, you're okay. Great. I love this interview. It's fun.
This is fun. I love Elizabeth. That's all I'll say about that.
Yeah.
And I do hope that you're bringing her back in the next one.
For sure. I am bringing her back in the Russian Endgame, for sure.
Oh, that's good. And she and Craig, well, we never know what's going to happen.
And you won't know in the Russian Endgame. It's very much of an open thing because they're two powerful people.
Well, that makes it even more interesting. This is just like Eve Duncan and Joe, who won't get married, and Iris won't let them. She told me that's not going to happen. So, you know, I gave her some thoughts on what I thought she should, you know, add in next. Not a bad idea.
Sure.
So, Lila is the sister of someone who's killed at the beginning. So, why don't they want her? Why do they want to get rid of her too?
Okay.
Who is she?
Okay. Who is she? She happens to be a person who's really kind of in the wrong place. at the wrong time, and she ends up knowing too much because her brother had been a colleague of Musa's, and her brother fell out, had a falling out with Musa. Mm. And as a result of that, because she knows too much information about what Musa and her group is doing, they won't permit her to they want to kill her off. I'm not going to say whether they do or not, but they want to. They view her as a risk and a threat. She's living in Marseille at the time as the book unfolds. She's run away from Paris, but in her background, therein is an interesting story. Is what is the fate and what are the difficulties that a young Muslim woman faces in France. And so part of her story is my way of bringing out some of those social factors as well.
Okay, so I'm going to ask one more question about the book, and then I'm going to close with a few just general questions so
sure.
we don't tell anybody anything.
Sure, right.
Okay, Musa is like a lot of other people. I mean, he is only loyal to himself.
Correct.
I know. There are a lot of people I know in the real world that are only loyal to themselves.
I live in Washington. Tell me about it, Fran.
Well, my cousin used to work in the Navy. He worked in the Pentagon before he retired.
Right.
And then he worked for Amtrak, and now he's got something. He refuses to retire.
Right.
And, Washington is an interesting place, I know.
Yeah. Anyhow, I interrupted your flow. So anyhow.
That's all right. That's okay. I'll make up another question. No problem.
Yeah.
Musa's loyal to himself.
Right.
Musa's
right.
loyal to himself. But how do we learn that, and how do other people learn that throughout the novel? And if you met him on the street, you might think he's cute, but I wouldn't trust him as far as I could throw him. And so how do people learn that about him? Was he so easily taken in, or people so easily taken in by him?
Well, I think actually people were, to some extent, taken in by him.
Taken in by him, yeah.
Yes, because he was smart, and he was idealistic, and he sounded as if he had a program that would lead to victory and that would change the status quo. And he talked a very, very good game, well educated, and he understood the forces, the social and demographic forces that were facing France. And so he also had, which is interesting as I think about your question, is there are some people who have kind of an innate or unique ability to lead. And I think he had that leadership potential that people will follow someone like that. And they may be leading you into the wrong place, but they have a kind of charisma which leads to others following. I think that's a large part of what he had, and I think he had a strong conviction that what he was doing was right. He may have been misguided, but he certainly had a strong conviction as well.
Yeah, there are a lot of people out there that we've read about in the past in the news and in history that have this strong charisma, and the people following them, and they just thought that what they offered them was better than what they had, and then they never realized that they were going to be in a worse place.
Exactly.
So,
exactly.
Yeah,
that's what happens as the book unfolds.
Even today, if you listen, read the news, or you just certain countries, people are so brainwashed. It's scary.
Yeah.
That they actually believe that they're better off in these particular situations. So writing a character in a series, how do you keep reader interest? I mean, Craig is a character that you're going to bring back. How do you make it so that he's different in every story so that people want him to come back?
Well, what for me, this was an evolution because, as I said, my first six books, I never did this before. But what happened was I got attached to the characters. I got attached to Craig and I got attached to Elizabeth. And so, but their relationship has to evolve. And there has to be enough that's interesting about them that you want to continue. Now, how did I do it? Well, one thing I did, I had him change jobs and change and change locales. And mm-hmm. I think that's very helpful to get him into a different position and into a different job. Because at the end of the first book, he's running a private security firm based in Milan. He's left the CIA, and she's a newspaper reporter who quits her job with a New York paper and teams up with Craig. All right. At the beginning mm-hmm. of the second book, he is the director of the EU counterterrorism office, mm-hmm. and she is now a newspaper reporter in Paris. Mm-hmm. So we've shifted the locale, we've moved them to France, mm-hmm. and that by way of trying to kindle and keep going with reader interest. They're in a different place. They now have a relationship, which they didn't have at the beginning of the first book. He's doing other things. And so those things, I think, make them almost altered characters, and I think that's important.
Well, there is a couple of twists in this book that we're not going to tell them about. So don't think
Correct.
This is all hunky-dory, people. Not good. Bad things do happen. That's all we'll say. We're not going to tell
Correct.
You more.
Correct. They do.
I mean,
do.
Yeah, bad things do happen, so you'll figure it out when you read the book. I have about 3 more questions. My
sure.
eyes are going buggy today. Are your books more plot-driven or character-driven? Iris said that her characters decide what's going to happen in the book. Do you have all your chapters outlined, or you just sit down and write when you start?
What I do is I do two things.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, I will put together a detailed outline. We're talking about a 50-page outline. And so
mm-hmm.
I want to have that of the story. But the other thing I do before I start to write is I will write out serious character descriptions of each
mm-hmm.
of the 3 or 4 major characters, the point of view characters. And I will write out not just their background, where they were born, where they went to school, what they're like, what things have happened to them. I
mm-hmm.
want to try to get to know those characters. So before I write, I have those detailed character profiles as well as the 50 pages. And I have a third thing. I have the factual background issue that I want to deal with. And only when I have those three do I start to write. Now, when I write,
mm-hmm.
talking about the characters, I use the approach of the shifting point of view, but among only my 4 point of view characters. And
mm-hmm.
and so the book will move among those characters. Other writers stick with one character. They would have Craig Page on every page of the novel. I don't like to write that way. But as a result, the reader will get to know those 4 point of view characters. And I think he will get to know Musa, General
mm-hmm.
Chu, as well as Craig and Elizabeth. And I tell the story through shifting point of view among those 4 characters.
Yeah, I made it easier because I've read books where there have been like 15 or 20 characters. Or sometimes a lot of authors will, title their chapters with the character's name. And
yep.
sometimes that's all right, and sometimes it gets a bit confusing. Because sometimes they shift back to the past, to the present, to the past, to the present, and you have to say, okay, this is Maria in the present, and then 3 chapters later she's in the past. So it makes it kind of hard sometimes. And when that happens, as an educator and a reading specialist, I take out my graphic organizer of my character analysis, and I, do a character page on each character before I review the book. And I get my little graphic organizer out there with the character's name and then the details of what the person does. And if I have to do that, it makes it kind of complicated to write the review. And then, there could be 5 or 6 or 7 characters. So this was easier.
Yeah, but the other thing which it does, back with your question about is
mm-hmm.
it plot-driven or character,
yeah.
I mean, the answer is it's both, but the character
mm-hmm.
thing is so important because unless
mm-hmm.
the reader can identify with, relate to, feel for
mm-hmm.
Your characters, I don't think people are going to want to keep turning pages and keep going. So, I mean, it's clearly important to work hard on those characters.
Well, I liked Craig. He's really interesting. I thought he was kind of like straightforward and honest. I liked Elizabeth, but I purposely did not, and I will probably later. I purposely did not read the next one. There's a chapter in the back of the book, people. If you read the Spanish Revenge, there's a chapter to entice you to read the Russian Endgame because there's a prologue and that's there. And I'm saying I better not read this because then I'm going to be disappointed because I'm not going to have the whole book.
Okay.
So I didn't read it because if I can't read the whole book, forget it. And I have one more. Is there a message in your writing that you want readers to get? So if you're even like a new person writing a mystery thriller or a mystery, what is the message that you want them to get when they read an Alan Topham great mystery book?
Oh, what's the message I want them to get? Well, in each of my books, I'm striving for two things. One, I want them, the first goal, I want them to be entertained and have a page turner that they won't turn out the lights at night. At least they won't very willingly. That's my first objective. But my second objective is I would like them to come away from each of my books saying to themselves, I learned something about a geopolitical issue in the world that I didn't know before. And to make it more specific, in The Spanish Revenge, I would like the reader to come away saying, gee, I hadn't thought about this conflict between Christians and Muslims in Western Europe. And what is this? And what's this going to mean for us in the United States? And how is this going to unfold? In The China Gambit, I wanted them to come away with the idea that China is a rising power, not just economically, but militarily, and it is going to be competing with the United States for domination, certainly in Asia or the world as a whole. And in other books, I wrote a book, A Woman of Valor, and in that book, I wanted people to come away with a sense about Israel and terrorism in the Middle East. So my books all have these. I'd like the reader to say, gee, I learned something from that book. I mean, because otherwise you read thrillers and somebody says, oh, yeah, that was a fun book. And then 6 months later, I can't even remember what it was about. But I'd at least like the reader to take away something. But that's a tricky thing to do, Fran, because on the one hand, I want people to learn, say, but on the other hand, I'm very careful not to have my characters lecture and not have page after page of sort of block type, because that destroys a novel. It has to be woven in almost subliminally without destroying the flow of the novel.
You're right, because I like I said, I've read almost 1,000 books in the last 3 years, I think, just about.
Oh my God.
I really have, seriously. It's scary. And when I can't remember the character of a book after finishing the book, it's not good. And it's happened once or twice where I've said, okay, I just finished that book 10 minutes ago. Who is the main character? Oh, my gosh, I better get the back of the book. And that tells you that the book is not 5 stars. It's maybe 3. I should say that if a book is 3 stars, I won't review it. And I won't rate it. I will just summarize the book because I don't believe in panning books and I don't write negative reviews. I write, I write honest reviews, and if I feel that a plot is not strong enough or a character is sort of not believable no matter what you do, I'm just going to summarize the book. Because somebody emailed me the other day and said, but did you like the book? I said I thought the book was very good, but it was lacking this, and I didn't want to put it in the review because the person had gotten a couple of really bad reviews and I didn't want to add to it. So I just said, you know what, it's really 4 stars, and that's just the way it is. And when they read my review, they said it was really good. Nobody knew that it wasn't, they didn't think it was bad. And a 4-star review isn't bad. So one more question.
Sure.
Would you ever kill off a main character?
I did that once, and I was sorry. The book was called A Woman of Valor, and actually all my books are up on e-books now, so all the old books are available. Mm-hmm. E-books are great, but from that respect. But anyhow, so I had this young woman who I created, and she was a We're maybe have a possibility of getting this one made into a movie. But she was when she was 12 years old, growing up in Alexandria, Egypt. She was from a Jewish family, and her family was expelled. And her father had been there for the family's been there for 2,000 years, and they left. And the father was broken, and she becomes then involved in an anti-terrorist unit for the Mossad. And what happens to her, it becomes a character study of her. And at the end of the novel is, I killed her off, and I was sorry afterwards. Mm-hmm. I don't mean right afterwards. I mean, I was sorry years later, because people said to me, they said, you know, that was your best book, Leora, and she's a wonderful character, and you should, you know, it's a shame. You could have brought her back. So I won't say never, but I don't want to do that again, really. And also, I think it bothered readers, because it jarred. Readers don't like that, I mean, when they're attached to a character. And I think I've matured a lot since I wrote that book. But
I just read a book by Edwin, I won't say which one, and he killed off one of the main characters twice. And the first one that I read by him, and then the last one that I read, and I go like, you didn't really do that to me. And he says, I said, would you kill off this character? And he said, yeah. I said, you better not. Because
right.
that was like one of my favorite. So before
right.
we close, could you tell
yes,
everybody
sir.
Where we can get all of your books and a little bit about the Russian Endgame?
Sure. Absolutely. First, taking them in the order that you have them, as far as all of my books, I've written now 8 books, and all dealing with different international issues.
Mm-hmm.
All 8 are available on ebook platforms. The China Gambit and Russian Endgame are right now, the paper books are available on Amazon, I know for sure. Some may still be in bookstores, but they don't stay in bookstores very long. So if you wanted the paper book, I would say the best bet on the Russian Endgame, I mean on Spanish Revenge or China Gambit, is Amazon. But ebook platforms for all the others, Kindle, maybe the Russian and Spanish may not be up on Nook yet, but clearly they're up on Kindle, those two, and all the books are up on Nook and all the other platforms. So that's where they are. The Russian Endgame will be coming out in September. It'll be in bookstores everywhere, hopefully, and up on ebook platforms pretty quickly thereafter. And the Russian Endgame picks up where the Spanish Revenge left off. Craig and is still in his battle with Chinese General Chu, where both are now dueling to gain revenge against the other. Elizabeth plays a major role in the novel, and the background issue that I deal with in the novel is a possible resurgence of Russian military power, that Russia will not simply go away, and that the Russian leader, with hoping that with an alliance with China, will be able to rebuild Russia militarily. And so that becomes the background issue, and then Craig and General Chu end up sparring off and continuing their battle.
I can't wait to read it, but then everybody else, you have to wait till September. I'm going to get it way before. I could tell you now.
Okay.
I am going to talk to Tracy. I'm going to email her. I was just checking my calendar, and I was checking the calendar for the Jewish holidays, because I don't do anything on the holidays in September. So I figure we're safe for the end of September. I'm just going to put that right over there, and I'll email her.
You'll never believe how early they are, Fran, the week of Labor Day.
I know. My birth, I was born on the first day of Rosh Hashanah in September.
Uh-huh.
We won't say what year or what century, but... That's beside the point. So they're kind of early. They're on Labor Day this year, the 4th
right.
to the 6th. And the week after is Yom Kippur, which is not my favorite day of the year, but it's a good way to start your diet, I can tell you that. But I don't have to worry about that. But I want to thank you a million times. Thank you so much, Alan. This is great. And I'm going to email Tracy as soon as my eyes stop bugging out from staring. I get eye strain when I can't read an e-book. That's it. I don't read e-books or PDF forever because my eyes start to bother me. I'm going to ask her, how about September 26th at 4? I'm not sure what date is the book coming out?
It should be out the beginning of September. Great.
Okay, so we're safe on the 26th then. We're safe over there.
Yeah,
okay,
great.
So that depends on your schedule. She'll let me know. She's amazing.
She is. She's terrific, really. I love this interview, Fran. You've done this a lot. You know what you're doing, and it's been wonderful. It's a lot of fun.
Thank
I really, really enjoyed it.
I have to tell you what I really do. I'm a reading and writing specialist, and I taught in the New York public school systems for a very long time. And when my mom was diagnosed with Alzheimer's, I had to retire. So I decided to write 10 books, which I did. They're not bestsellers, but we're getting there. We're getting close. We're trying.
Good for you. Great.
And, I do these interviews because I love it. I'm having fun, and I love showcasing great authors like yourself. And I do book reviews because I do, and I decided that when I retired, I wasn't going to become a couch potato. So this is fun, and I'm going to email Tracy, and thank you so much, Alan. I appreciate it.
Well, it's been my pleasure, really, Fran. Look forward to talking to you again.
Thank you, and we will be back next Thursday at 4 with Donna Fletcher Crowe and Dr. Mark Rubenstein. On that night, Bethany, are you okay? Okay, we're going to log out, and good night, everybody.